Welcome in to the newest edition of the Just In Time Sports Podcast. I am your host, Justin Jackson. And this week's episode, we'll be discussing the Olympics and what's happening over in Paris. We'll be discussing the NFL and what's happening in training camp as America's sport is roaring back. And we'll have our Jack's hot take. Now, as always, don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe to the Just In Time Sports Podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Amazon, wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, don't forget to follow at JTime Sports on all of your favorite social medias. I repeat, at JTime Sports on all of your favorite social medias in order to get breaking news, updates, highlights, etc. Now, as always, don't forget to sit back and get ready to learn something.
JTS. Yeah. Just In Time Sports.
Life is good. Life is good.
Look. This is Just In Time Sports. Come and get your weekly takes. His opinion from the heart. He can never show you fake. If you winning or you losing, he gon' tell it to you straight. How we talking basketball without a Jordan Brown debate? If you got the hottest takes, you better come and make your case. If you win a couple games, he might even show you grace. JTS on every platform, we growing adaptation. Numbers going off the charts, we create the separation. Louisiana till I die, it's where I'm from, I can't replace it. So people minds are obtuse, but I like to be adjacent. Giving my opinion like I'm Nick Ryder, I'm Jason. ESPN, better watch out, cause I'm coming for the spaceship. We even tweeting on Twitter, you can meet us in the spaces. Highlight clips of sports news, yeah, you gotta embrace it. We never had it easy, we just came from the pavement. I might be controversial, but I like to make my statements. This is Just In Time Sports, come and get your weekly takes. His opinion from the heart, he can never show you fake.
He can never show you fake.
Look, if you winning or you losing, he gon' tell it to you straight.
He gon' tell it to you, he gon' tell it to you, he gon' tell it to you.
This is Just In Time Sports, come and get your weekly takes.
Come and get it,
he gon' tell it to you straight, to you straight.
Welcome into the show. It has been far too long without you guys. It was unplanned of a break, so my apologies to you guys for not announcing and staying more communicative. As far as letting you guys know scheduling, I'm usually a lot better in that. My apologies. Just In Time Sports Podcast brought to you by IMS Productions, along with, of course, myself. But again, my sincerest apologies to you guys for that. It was unplanned. I usually do take a break during the summer, right after the NBA finals, right before NFL training camp. I usually take a break about a couple of weeks, never truly this long. But it is a couple of weeks that I usually take a break. If you guys notice, we go back in my previous seasons, it's usually, like I said, right after the finals, it's a couple of weeks and then I usually come back. But I took about a month this time. It was unplanned. Little life stuff. Like I said, first time I've done two sports in the summer. I was doing girls basketball and football. And then, honestly, kind of just wanted to enjoy life a little bit. And I enjoy doing this. I really do. It always makes me happy to get in the booth and talk to you guys. But it just wasn't the right time, honestly, for, like I said, about a month. And I had the itch last week. I'm like, man, I hadn't recorded in a while. I hadn't done a podcast in a while. I was trying to get stuff finalized with the production company. And just, it was a bunch of stuff happening behind the scenes, peeling back the curtain a little bit. Well, I haven't talked with you guys, but I am back. I plan on going balls to the wall weekly from here through football season. So that's Super Bowls in February. So from now, which is August, you guys are here this August 6th. Through the first week of February, so like a 6-month grind. I plan on being weekly from here on out. Shout out my man B-Roy again for the intro song. I was a little nervous coming back. I haven't done this in a month, and so just putting the stuff together and getting everything set up, and then I heard the intro song and it got me up, it got me hype, ready to go. But I am excited to be with you guys. Like I said, I'm recording this late Monday night. You guys are here this Tuesday morning. But our first topic, we're gonna tackle the world stage, and then we're gonna come back more local. We're gonna start off with the Olympics, the 2024 Paris Olympics. They'll be in LA in 2028. Fingers crossed, I'm in LA for the Olympics. I would love to see basketball at the Olympic stage in LA. I figure that'd be insane, right? It won't be the GOAT tour like it is now. Like Steph, KD, and LeBron, they'll all should be past that point, but you'll have your Anthony Edwards, your Cooper Flags, your Tyreek Halliburton's. Embiid may go one more. Bam Adebayo loves international game. That may be AD's last ride, especially because it'll be in LA. But cool. Nah, Kawhi's not going to play. I don't even know why I said that. Kawhi don't play for the Clippers. He ain't going to play for Team USA. But that'd be pretty dope. But the Olympics right now are in Paris, and despite all of their controversies, we had opening ceremony controversy. We had the Seine River controversy where they were trying to do the triathlon, and it was like the water levels were like toxic or whatever. It was dirty water. And then now, like, reportedly people are getting sick all over the place because they said they cleared it. And then now people are getting sick all over the place from a random assortment of diseases due to the Seine water, the Seine River water, which conveniently or interestingly enough, there was a movie that came out recently on Netflix about sharks in the Seine River. And it was like the president of France or whatever she was, whoever ruled, whatever the lady's title was, that ruled over the France, was like, no, we're gonna have this big swimming competition in the Seine River anyway, because there's no way there's sharks in the river, kind of thing. Like, and then a whole group got eight. They end up blowing it up, flooding all of Paris by blowing some stuff up, because there was, you know, it was a long one of those movie endings in a sci-fi movie where every little thing ends in this massive, like I said, they end up flooding Paris, like under multiple feet of water. But again, it was like the Seine River was the center of it. So now fast forward to real life, you have a pollution issue with the Seine River and the people cleared it. And then people popping up sick left and right, due to the water. So, hey, that's the risk you take swimming in a natural body of water. Now, of course, the triathlon, like when they go to LA, I'm sure they're going to swim in a river in LA, if there is one, or they'll find a river in nearby, like Long Beach. You know, they'll find somewhere to swim, to do the swimming part of the triathlon, wherever they can, but it'll be better than it is in the Seine River, right? But that is not what I want to talk to you guys about. I remember talking about the Seine River and diseases, but this got off track early. Anyway, let's go to the medal count. Again, this is as of 10:50 p.m. Central Standard Time. This is the medal count from where Team USA is sitting. Currently, we are up 79-53 in medals, and we are tied with China with 21 goals. China is actually this country in second with 53 medals. So if that was a team champion, America's first, China is second. Big kudo. I mean, America's supposed to, right? Like, we had 300 Olympians. We had our own boat and was packed to the brim like sardines in a can on the opening ceremony. Again, on the Seine. The opening ceremony is like with some iconic shots of Team USA. That was, you know, we had the most Olympians. We're the best at a lot. We have the GOATs at a lot of stuff. So there's certain events where you're, as a country, not going to win. You're not going to win basketball, men and women. You're not going to win all-around gymnastics as a woman. Simone Biles had an off-Olympics, quote-unquote. You're not going to win. Like, you just start saying you're not going to win. Like, there's certain people who come into the Olympics with the expectation of they're going to win. You come in with shot put, you're not going to win it. You're not going to beat us in shot put. Like, it's just that so certain stuff, you come in with an expectation to win. You get that a lot with, like, you know, back in the olden days, the Russian gymnast, like, she's going to come in, she's going to win the Olympics. It wasn't until 2012, I want to say, the Gabby Douglas Olympics, where Team USA Women's Gymnastics, like, for the first time, like, took down people and was like, oh my God, they can actually do this. And then the Simone Biles reign begins the next Olympics. But speaking of Simone Biles and what I believe is her final Olympics, she went out almost as good as any as you could have. She wins. She participates in the in the 4x4 team, in the four in the team all around event, affectionately known as Efferon and Find Out, more formally known as the Golden Girls, and they got the name Golden Girls because, well, Efferon and Find Out came from one of the former teammates of Team USA Women's Gymnastics, basically slandering the team. Saying a bunch of derogatory stuff about the team that, you know, if you're a supporter, especially an ex-teammate, you shouldn't be saying that sort of stuff. But she said a lot of derogatory comments about the team. And so Simone Biles, after they won, tweeted out the team nickname, Efferon and Find Out. And then it comes out later, and she that catches fire because it's not something you get from athletes often in general, especially you don't get it from Simone Biles. She's usually pretty diplomatic and pretty formal, and for her to go to Efferon and Find Out, it's like, oh, okay. And then knowing the controversy of what happened that led to that moment really, really sparked the interest of a lot of people. And so then she had to come out like a day later and be like, no, like the team name is truly and truly the Golden Girls because we're older and they're like the oldest U.S. team ever or something like that. Because, I mean, Simone herself is 27, which I'm 27. But like her 27 in gymnastics years is like 47. It's like 37 in any other sport. Like, you know, you're supposed to be done at 23. Like, you're a 23-year-old gymnast, so you're kind of old. Like, you really get two cracks at Olympics. You really get the Olympic between 16 and 20, and then the Olympic between 21 and 24. You don't usually get a third crack at it. Like, if you hit it, if you hit the first time at 16, you hit it again at 20, you might get it at 24. You don't get it at 28, right? So the fact she's 27, and there's a possibility she comes back at 31 to compete in L.A., is insane. But she wins, she participates in, and she leads, let's be honest, she leads the team event all around gold. She wins the individual event all around gold. She does not medal in vault. No, she doesn't medal in balance beam because she fall off the beam. And I think she silvers or bronzes in vault. But her event's the floor. Her mastery level's the floor, and everybody knows it. Her routine, her difficulty is routinely 6.97, and everybody else's difficulty is 6.1. So you're coming in with a 0.8 of a point advantage, and gymnastics is massive. They'd be like in a basketball game, if you came in the game, you were up 15 to start. Like, you started off up 15 just because of the way you played or whatever. Like, so because, like, and the lady was winning, I think of her first name, but her last name is Andrade from Brazil. Her routine difficulty is a 6.1. Simone's a 6.9. So there's 0.8 of a difference she has to make up just from the difficulty standpoint. Now, there's no way on the planet anybody beats Simone Biles in the floor unless Simone Biles basically gives it to you. Because she can execute her routine way less crispy than the person with the lower difficulty. And as long as she doesn't step out of bounds or commit a fault, she's going to win because she can have 0.6 lower on execution and still beat you by 0.2. You know what I'm saying? Because of her difficulty level. Well, that's what Simone Biles did on the floor. She was battling. It was reported early in the Olympics she had an ankle calf injury. I didn't watch the women all around, but I did notice in the individual all around, she was wearing a calf wrap. Okay, interesting. Usually she's bare leg at the bottom. Like, you see some gymnasts, they wrap their feet almost like staying them, almost making shoes with the wrap. They get a really heavy heel wrap, a really heavy arch wrap, and they almost like make shoes with their wrap. Usually Simone is pretty bare legged, you know what I'm saying, as far as protection. So she has a calf wrap. But she wins gold, right? And balance beam, I saw her fall off in the individual. She did her skill, which is what we say, like a trick, a flip. She did her skill, and then she just kind of stared at him like she stepped off. Like, whatever feeling she wanted to get when she landed, she didn't like it, and she just kind of like, she didn't like volunteer to just step off, but it wasn't the fight she would normally have had to balance herself on the beam just to stay on. Like, she did her skill, and then she just went off. And it was like, was it a situation where she's injured and she feels it, and she's kind of like, I can't do what I want to do because I just don't have the body right now? Or the situation was, it was just that bad of a mess up and she had no choice. But then in floor, individual floor, which is, again, she starts off with almost a near point advantage. Maybe like you're starting off with almost 20 point lead in basketball, or you're starting off up 10 in football. Like, I have to make up, I have to execute so much better than you just to beat you, because of your advantage. So fast forward to floor. A few girls are going, they're really battling for bronze, because they pretty much, you think in your brain, silver and gold are going to be between Andrade and Simone Biles. And Andrade's had a hell of a story. She has 3 torn ACLs. She's older. Like, she's bigger. Like, you don't typically have, I mean, everybody looks giant compared to Simone Biles, but she looks like she's above 5'5", 5'6", which is tall for a woman with multiple ACLs. Like, usually that story doesn't happen in gymnastics, but you go into the floor thinking, okay, it's Andrade or it's Biles as far as gold. Bronze is up for debate. You had Suni Lee, and you had a few other women that were all vying for bronze potentially when they showed up. So some of those women start going. So Simone Biles sneaks onto the mat. And I say sneak, but of course you're in an arena. She goes to the mat to basically test her ankle and her ankle calf. And she goes for a flip, and she goes for a skill. And when she does it, she just looks like her feet barely touch the ground. She just sits back and almost like blows her coach's knee out. And her coach is like, what's wrong? And you can see her mouth about like her calf doesn't straighten or something. And so they go back to rapping, and she's basically trying to nod to herself and tell herself, like, you got one routine. Like, you can be hurting later. You got to do this one time. Andrade lays down a nearly perfect routine, especially considering, but her skill was not as high. So I'm going in thinking, okay, 14 point. I think Andrade wins with a 14.1. 14.1 is not going to hold tomorrow. She's going to start off with a 7. So that means in order for her not to past 14 points, gonna have a half the execution of a 7.0 or lower. That's almost impossible. And she didn't do that. She instead had her major. She was pulling her stuff out, but she stepped out of bounds twice. Each out of bounds step is minus 0.3. She would have won by 0.477. She ends up losing by 0.133. So Andrade takes the gold, Simone Biles takes the silver, and then Suni Lee, after a rescore, gets the bronze in floor. Look, to me, Simone Biles is the greatest gymnast of all time. Now, you can put whoever you want up there. That's cool. She's the most decorated American gymnast ever. She has 5 or 6 skills named after her in gymnastics, one on each event. One on vault, one on balance beam, one on uneven bars, like one on the floor. She is truly a legend who changed the game. There is multiple stories about how she, when her teammate, I want to say it's Suni Lee, or Jordan Childs, one of the two, but they were basically on the verge, if not quitting gymnastics, like forever. And she got the person to move down to Biles' studio in the Houston area. And it's like, no, you're going to work here. And then I think it was Jordan Childs. But then they end up going to this games and meddling. And it's like, you know, like, my career was over. I was throwing in the towel. It didn't work for me. It is what it is. And then Simone steps up, like I say, invites me to her house her camp, etc. Really teach that person how to be a gymnast again, instilling that confidence in them. And then now they're meddling. So she's the most accomplished female gymnast of all time. And the only reason why, again, if she were to participate in all 4 individuals and the woman all around and the team all around, she can get the 6 gold medals in the Olympics. Michael Phelps was like undefeated in Beijing, and he went 8 for 8. But again, swimming to me is a much easier thing. There's four different swimming events just for the 100 meter. Like, there's the backstroke, there's the breaststroke, there's like freestyle, and there's something else. Like, just for the 100 meter. So it was like, if you did it for 100 meter and 200 meter and 4x1 and 4x2, there's 16 medal opportunities just in the 200 meter and shorter swimming. Like, and then as opposed to, you know, Simone Biles, there's six total events she can enter. And really and truly, it's almost impossible. Like, I don't think I've ever heard anybody enter all six. So, like, that is something that I think needs to be taken into consideration. But to me, she's one of the greatest Olympian of all time from the United States. I mean, what she did historically, she's on the Mount Rushmore of Olympians. What she did historically is unmatched and it's unrivaled. And I think it's going to remain that way for quite a long time. But if she is done, if the floor was her last routine, if her moment in the spotlight for the last time as a competitor is giving credence and props to Andrade, who had a hell of a life story, then she's earned that to be her way out. And hopefully we'll get her in front of camera accepting some sort of lifetime award in the not so distant future. Team USA basketball. Oh, man. So, Team USA basketball, they're both teams are 3-0. I'll start with the women and go to the men. So, the women's side have won 58 straight games. They have not lost a game in the Olympic tournament, I believe, since 1996 was the last time that a women's team lost in the Olympics. The most dominant team of all time. Think about it, they haven't lost a basketball game in 22 years. They are truly like that. I remember it was funny, so funny. In that first game, we were playing Japan, and Japan's tallest player was 6'1", and Team USA could legitimately put a lineup on the floor where the whole thing is 6'3", 6'4", taller. Brittany Griner, Alyssa Thomas, Nafisa Collier, Asia Wilson, Breonna Stewart. They can legitimately put a lineup on the floor that is 6'3", 6'4", or taller. And the Japanese tallest player was 6'1". It's just, you know, the old thing where it's like, man, the players of the world are catching up to the NBA players. They don't even have that discussion on the women's side. Like, no, they're not. Like, we get it. You want a story for the men's side. We get it. We understand. Don't bring that nonsense over here because it's not even relatively close between the women and the men. Now, I will say this. There was more dogfights this year than in times past. Definitely that. Like, Team Germany gave Team USA a scare on the women's side. Who are they? Because the Netherlands? I think it was the other team, like, gave them a scare. It was a scrap up until late. Like, so it's not a situation where they're catching up. I think that they are more together because they get a chance to play together. Like, unless you're dropping in a WNBA player, then your senior national team pretty much is already in your country. So, like I said, unless you're dropping in an NBA player, there's not a WNBA player, I'm sorry, that's not a whole lot to adjust to. And even then, it's running through a couple sets. So that's what's happening on the women's side. Asia Wilson and Breonna Stewart are just flat out unfair. Those are two best players in the W. Them being on the same, those two best female players in the world, those two being on the same front court, it's flat out unfair. No one can do anything. Even when those two quote unquote struggle, they're still dominating their opponents. So, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow, is that those two are balling, not even really to the best of their potential, and you're still getting punished. And on the men's side, impressively, the men got out of the group stage undefeated. Now, the world is getting a lot closer to the USA men than they are to the USA women. However, the problem with the world is that they're so spread out. Luka Doncic plays for Slovenia. Giannis Antetokounmpo plays for Greece. Joel Embiid plays for Team USA. Victor Wembanyama plays for France. But who's he with? Rudy Gobert? They don't have any guards. So it's just, you know, the rest of the world may have a star here. So the Jokic is playing for Serbia. You know, the rest of the world may have a star here or a star there, but ultimately Team USA is expected to win the basketball tournament. Hell, we invented the game. So 3-0 through the group play. Now, the other three top teams in the world on the other side of the bracket. So there is a chance that A, team can set up for anybody in the finals, but B, that you end up, if you are Team USA men, you end up playing somebody with like a grudge in the finals. Like, would it be Canada? Like, you know, if they get to the finals, they're going to be talking a whole lot and trying to do stuff to get under people's skin. So, like I said, would it be Canada? That would probably be the one team that Team USA wouldn't want to see in a Olympic finals. Shifting over to Noah Lyles. So, Noah Lyles is the track runner who came out, was it right after the Celtics? Right after somebody had won. And they asked him about it, and he was like, how could you be the world champion if you never beat the entire world? Basically saying that the NBA doesn't play outside of its borders, so how can you be a world champion and you don't play outside of the National Basketball Association? It's not like you're going to play teams in Spain and teams in England and teams in France, and because I didn't lose any of them, king of the world. No. So that's going to be our discussion on Noah Lyles, rather. But so he gets an opportunity. He runs track, of course. So there's an NBA Twitter hate watch, basically. Like, everybody is sitting there waiting on him to run the 100 meter, because if he loses, there's going to be a near infinite amount of slander. And in the closest race in my lifetime, I've never seen a track race closer. This is like when you hold out your hands as a little kid, you take it to race, and they slap your hands, and you really don't know who slapped you first. Same concept. Noah Lyles was awarded the victory because his chest crossed the line at 5/100ths of a second faster than it was closed, and he was locked out. Like, any other decision, path, flight novel, any of that, barely made it. And so that is humongous pressure. He goes out, he wins by 5/100ths of a second. He's officially the fastest man in the world. And he kind of backs out all the talk, and he's been quite inspirational ever since then, but he's the fastest man in the world. So congratulations to Noah Lyles. All right, so before we go, U.S. soccer is a joke. That's just put it out there. U.S. soccer is awful. Now, the women's side is really, really good. They played 5 matches, 4 wins, no loss and a draw. That's really, really good. They're my pick every year to win the gold is the women's U.S. women's soccer team. But the men? Oh, the men, poo. We have to do something with the men in soccer. I don't know if it's bringing them in early, to where they are identified as first talent at 10 to 12 years old, and now they're in this academy where they get to learn how to play senior national level soccer. It's just bad. Like, it was our first win in a match in the Olympics since like 2004. You know, and the women are like, oh, we had a down year, we got bronze. And it's like, you guys are like, we had an up year, we came in 6th. Like, it's just, It's mind-boggling how bad the U.S. soccer team is, especially with the kind of resources that we have at our disposal. But up next, we're going to shift to the NFL and talk about what's going down there. Welcome back to the show, and now we're going to discuss the NFL. It's training camp time. It's hope time. It's no matter how bad your team is, how many negative reports come out, common sense, your Madden rating, people slandering you on Twitter for being a fan of the team, no matter what happens,
training camp time? Time to be hopeful.
It is a time to have hope. It is a time to have little discernment. It is time to have all the best means and read all the articles that you want to read. And it is just a time for an information overload on the consumer, but along with the team. You know, in fact, the team is being asked by a different report every day. It is a worn out time in this calendar. Like I said, it's just a period of hope. Mostly irrational, but you're hopeful. And so let's go through some training camp stuff that's happening now. Pittsburgh has a legitimate battle for QB1 between Justin Fields and Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson is making, you know, 50-some-odd million dollars a year, but Russell Wilson is only costing Pittsburgh a couple of million because most of the contract is still being paid off using the dead money from the Denver Broncos. So financially, they're under no major obligation to play him. Also, they sent a little compensation to the Bears and got Justin Fields because everybody and their grandma knew you kind of had to remove the returning quarterback to get the new guy in. And so because of which, they gave Chicago basically nothing for Fields, which again, same thing. I'm in no obligation to play him either. So because of which, it allows you to have a true quarterback battle where you're not financially obligated, you're not tilting the fact you have a returning starter, you don't have a locker room favorite, you don't have a guy with tape in uniform. Like, there's so many different things that usually a quarterback quote-unquote battle has that's behind the scenes. The GM doesn't care. He traded for one and signed another for cheap. The QB coach doesn't care. It's not like he was with the guy for 10 years and the guy made the QB coach and now he's up for all these other jobs. Like, no one cares besides having the best guy on the field. And that is reportedly a very interesting battle. Russell Wilson was sick for a couple of days, missed a couple of days. So Justin Fields stepped up and took first team reps. He looked pretty good. So that's one of the most intriguing QB battles in camp, which is a rarity. Like I said, there's usually so many outside forces. There's, you know, it's hard to, I'm trying to think of a big money quarterback that, like Deshaun Watson, for instance. It didn't matter how well the backup played. You can't trade Deshaun Watson. You can't cut him financially. And I'm not going to put $50 million on the bench. So he's the starter. You know what I'm saying? Like, but there's no financial obligation in Pittsburgh to play either guy. So the best guy will get the job. So that's going to be intriguing to watch through the preseason and through camp. Like I said, who becomes the week one starter? I personally think Russell Wilson, but you know, Russ is a couple of bad quarters away from Justin Fields jogging on. And I do think that's the one thing, though, that the Steelers are dancing with. You can go pretty easily from Wilson to Fields. Wilson starts, he's 2-2, starts the fifth game, it's kind of rough, you yank him, you go Fields, and it's Fields' show. It's hard to go from Fields to Wilson. Same scenario, except now Fields gets yanked and it's Wilson. You can't ever go back to Fields. Like, the Fields experiment didn't work. Now you're on the Russell Wilson thing. So I think that whenever you make the switch, you got to switch it and you're stuck. Like, I feel like once you put Fields in the game, Russell Wilson's time is over. Once you put Russ in the game, Fields' time is over. And like, once that person gets switched, it's hard to do. I just think that you'll get a lot more PR positivity going from Russ to Fields juxtaposed to going from Fields to Russ. So I think that's something that is in the back of the mind of the Pittsburgh organization, although Mike Tomlin is usually not one to care about what the media thinks. Speaking of QBs, that it doesn't matter because of financial situations, the Atlanta Falcons, everyone's favorite of the NFL draft, is officially in camp. And of course they have their two quarterbacks. They have the guy who they paid like $150 million to in the offseason and then subsequently drafted his replacement 2 years later. 2 weeks later. I mean, you know, whatever. A couple months later, they subsequently drafted his replacement in the first round. Top 10. I don't understand it either. But that's what they did. And again, it doesn't matter how good Michael Penix plays. Kirk Cousins owed a lot of money. Kirk Cousins is going to be the starting quarterback for the Atlanta Falcons. Now, Kirk Cousins is also routinely, habitually, the 10th best quarterback in football. Some guys go above, some guys come below. Kirk Cousins always end up at 10. And I always say this, like, man, people hear me say that and they go, man, like, he's not Kirk Cousins is the 10th best quarterback in the league. Kirk Cousins ain't top 10. And I always go, name 10 guys better. You start to falter at about 7 or 8. Then guys I know that are, you know, I strongly believe are under, I just start naming them. And people go, no, Kirk. So I was like, okay, you get to a couple names you debate below. You get to a couple names you debate above. Right in the middle, Lance at 10. He's always a 10th best quarterback. It just is what it is. Even in the, I think in the Madden ratings, he's 10th. When they did the top 100 players, I think he was like the 10th quarterback. Like, that is what it is. Like, he's the 10th best quarterback. So because you had a top 10 quarterback, turning right around and drafting another quarterback is interesting. Is an interesting situation. But hey, they seem to be making it work. Reportedly, Cousins is none too keen on helping the young fella. However, it is 2 years down the line for what even matters. Like, at the earliest, it's 2 years from now. In the perfect financial situation, it's 3 years from now. The only thing is, you'd have to make a choice on Penix's fifth-year option without really seeing him play meaningful snaps if the decision is to move on from Kirk Cousins after 3 years. So that is something to keep our eye on there. Another dual quarterback situation, the New England Patriots. They have a few things going on. We'll kind of tackle them all at once. So they have a two quarterback reported situation as well. Of course, they went number 3 overall, Drake May out of North Carolina. I have my concerns with him pre-draft, most of which, based on the video I've seen, have been cleaned up. However, the New England Patriots also drafted a walking howitzer of a quarterback named Joe Milton III. I remember when Joe Milton was at Michigan. Man, that was a great game. He was so big and so physical. And it looks like being big and intimidating and amazing blue just looks cooler. He was so big and so intimidating and throw it a country mile. And especially in that offense system where it was pro style, where they'd run the ball, you know, 60% of the time out of two tight end. Like, when he got those shot opportunities, he was letting it fly. But also, he moves on to Tennessee. He gets into the SEC, up and down, and consistent starter. Again, some of the stuff he did not clean up in Michigan. Well, when you know, his trash just followed him to Tennessee, and now he's doing the same stuff in Tennessee. So, because of this point, he falls in the draft much further than he should have. But he ends up a Patriot as well. Now, again, back to the reports. There are reports that are saying that Milton's outplaying May. I find that hard to believe, throw for throw, whatever. I do believe, however, there's been more wow moments with Joe Milton. Because people are saying that Drake May is Mac Jones reincarnated. There's nothing about Drake May besides being a white Caucasian male that is Mac Jones. He is more accurate than Mac Jones. He throws the ball a lot harder than Mac Jones. He has more natural arm talent than Mac Jones. He's more athletically gifted than Mac Jones. It's just, again, Mac Jones is semi-undersized, weaker arm, marginally athletic. Drake May is none of those things. The problem is he's usually standing beside a giant with a cannon who's athletic, and that's Joe Milton. So by comparison, yeah, it may be 75-yard pass versus a 55-yard pass or 60-yard pass. Like, 60 yards is still impressive as heck. 55 yards is still impressive as heck. But he's not 80. Like, you know what I'm saying? Joe Milton threw for about 80 yards. Like, when they were doing this warm-up video, Drake May, like, flicked it. He goes, like, 20, 25 yards with a good arc. Milton flips it, and it goes, like, 35 yards, moon ball. And it's like, there's just a level of arm talent you can't coach. So I think that there is, if I just never seen the practice footage, just seeing the report, and knowing the two players, I would say that it's probably not playing better. It's probably playing with more excitement, more wow, more pop, because of the ability to run. And again, the absolute cannon, the absolute howitzer known as his right arm, attached to his shoulder. Also, New England Patriots land, Matthew Judon is still without a contract. There was a bunch of weird, like, hugging and walking off practice fields and other stuff that is trying to bubble its way into the conversation regarding Matt Judon in his contract. But that is a situation that hopefully is resolved soon, whether that is by trade or by agreeing to a contract. So, so hopefully that it gets done soon. Well, ingrained in a contract extension. But going out wide, we're going to start East Coast and go West Coast. So Brandon, Malik Nabers, he looks legit. Like every pass I've seen from Daniel Jones looks off, but he looks absolutely legit. He looks like the kind of guy that when Burrow got chased, it looked like Burrow walked in the stadium differently. Like, okay, I got him. So worst come to worst, I got him. And they got, and the team got us. We're going to be all right. We're going to be fine. Like, absolutely, Malik Nabers is just, he's that guy. Like, he's unquestioned the number one receiver. He's a number one receiver in this league. The dude is ridiculous as far as the stuff we've been seeing out of camp. I mean, it's just, he's so good. I made a joke with my friends. He may save Daniel Jones' job. He's that good. Where Daniel Jones may throw a couple of bad passes, and then Nabers make some crazy catch and falls into the end zone. You know what I'm saying? Daniel Jones' job is saved. Like, that is how much of a talent that young man is. And speaking of a talented receiver, I'm going to go to the West Coast. So, in the West Coast, there's a receiver named Brandon Ayuk. Now, he is seeking a resolution. I tweeted about this on Instagram, etc. He is tweeting a resolution to his contract situation. Whether he gets paid again by the Niners, and this time market value, he's looking at about 35-ish a year, 33-ish a year, per reports. You know, so he's looking to be fairly compensated for his production. He would like to be traded to a situation who could fairly compensate his production. So, the two teams that are in now, reportedly, after the Steelers bow out, and the Ravens reportedly bow out, it is the Steelers and us. As far as, and by us, I mean the Patriots, as far as landing Brandon Ayuk. So, both situations have the financial capital. Both situations have the draft pick. It'll ultimately, to me, come down to Brandon Ayuk's agent and the new team. Why do you say that? Ayuk is, I can almost guarantee it. If I had to bet my life, I wouldn't, but I think about it. Ayuk has been already, and Ayuk's camp has already been negotiating with teams regarding a contract for Ayuk when he lands on the plane. Like, when he gets on the plane and passes a physical, where's the contract we talked about? Like, that is how, because it's a financially driven decision. So he's going to be looking for that contract the second he lands, wherever he decides to go. So that is going to be something that is incredibly tough to deal with for the 49ers, is trying to make this work. Because at the same time, that they're dealing with this, they're dealing with Trent Williams too. But so now back to the trade itself, there's a double prong situation. So on the Cleveland Browns side, reportedly, it's Amari Cooper plus picks. Now, Amari Cooper just guaranteed a significant amount of his contract. The last 2 years of his deal is officially guaranteed. So unless the Niners agree to pay the guarantees off, it makes him being traded this year unlikely. The other team is the New England Patriots. Now, reportedly, their offer is Kendrick Bourne plus picks. I would like it to be Kendrick Bourne plus Juju Smith-Schuster plus picks, but hey, everybody can't be choosy. And so that is what is going on there with the Brandon Ayuk deal. We'll keep you guys posted on that whenever we are. And then, of course, there's been some big contracts handed out in the recent days. Just let me pull up the list. I have a relative list. I'm trying to figure out if I want to go back. All right, so Taylor Decker, who's the left tackle for the Lions, he signed 3 years, $60 million with the Lions. Jordan Love got his bag, 4 years, $220 million, with a $75 million signing bonus and $155 million guaranteed. Julius Jabril Peppers and the New England Patriots win 3 years, $30 million. The Seattle Seahawks and Julian Love win 3 years, $36 million. DJ Moore and the Chicago Bears went 4 years, $110 million with $82.6 million guaranteed. Devon Godshaw and the New England Patriots went 2 years, $21 million with $16.5 million guaranteed. Tristan Wirfs sets the record for the offensive lineman. He goes 5 years, $140.63 million, including $88.24 million guaranteed. So he's the highest paid offensive lineman ever. Trying to think, that's pretty much. Oh, Tyreek Hill and the Dolphins renegotiate his contract that pays him. Now he gets basically 3 years, $90 million with $65 million guaranteed. And then Harrison Butker sets the record for kickers as he goes 4 years, $25.6 million with $17.75 million guaranteed. So that is the breakdown of the major contracts that's been happening in the NFL over the past few weeks. Like I said, I didn't get all of them, but all of them are tweeted on the Just in Time Sports social medias. Shout out my new Instagram fans. Huge shout out to you guys. Glad that you are part of the Just in Time Sports family. But up next, we're going to have Jack's Hot Take, which is going to be about the WWE. Welcome back into the show. And now we're going to discuss Jack's Hot Take. It's going to be quick. We're just going to be about the WWE being cool again. And I mean really cool again. And that was kind of like Triple H, Paul Levesque, who was like the COO of the company now. Basically the head man in charge. He said it like, you know, wrestling is cool again. Like, it is. Like, the storylines we're having, like, it's insane. Like, SummerSlam was insane as far as storytelling, long-term storytelling, stuff being wrapped up, stuff being started. Ever since, it's been a year and a half long process of WrestleMania 39, you know, Roman defeats Cody. Then there's a year-long story that ends up bringing The Rock back and all these new Samoans. And then Cody beats Roman, sends Roman off to the ether. Rock goes back to Hollywood. And then now Cody's the man. But now there are these new Samoans showing up, the Tongans, and then Jacob Fatu. And then you get rid of Paul Heyman. Roman's gone. Roman's back at SummerSlam. His return has 100 million views in 24 hours or 48 hours, which is more views than CM Punk or John Cena's return has on WWE socials. Some of the loudest pops I've ever heard in my life. For those who don't understand what a pop is in WWE, pops are like crowd reactions. So like when your music hit, the crowd yells. When you do something, the crowd does it with you. Like, those are considered pops. So some of the loudest pops I've ever heard in my life. And it's just like, it's cool again. Like, people talk about it openly. It's almost like when you were a kid and WWE was like, we talk about it with your friends. Now it's like, no, it's like active discourse on social media. People are talking about it in schools. Older kids are watching it. Like, it is something that adults are tuning in and having open conversations about it. It is something that was not possible 2 years ago. Like, you know, and credit a lot of people in WWE for sticking to it and battling their guns and fighting their cash cow and riding that cash cow until we get to this point until he felt, you know, everybody felt that comfortable enough that, okay, he could pass it on because it's stable. But then that cash cow returned and no one cared about anybody else. And it was it's funny. It was like when Roman was like 7 years ago, and it's kind of off topic, but like 7 years ago, Roman was getting booed religiously, and not because he was a heel, people just hated him. And then he goes away, he reinvents like this head of the table persona. People love to hate him. then he's gone and everybody's like, he left, everybody's like, oh my God, he's exactly what we always wanted. And now he's back as a baby face, I guess. Now he's back as a face, or anti-face, in order to try and take down his family and the rest of the blood. Like, it's insane, right? Like, the level of detail, level of storytelling, and it's just, and I can't wait to watch, right? Like, I cannot wait to tune in. There's all kind of stuff happening. There's implosions happening. Like, it's wild to see. And like I said, it's WWE being cool again. It's fun again. Pro wrestling is fun again, in the words of Paul Levesque. And I don't see it slowing down. They have the right engines behind it. They have the right machines behind it. They're making all kind of deals. They're going to Netflix soon, in which everybody's saying they will not be censored when they go to Netflix. Like, this is going to be drastically entertaining. We'll see how long ago. I mean, it's the longest running weekly episodic show in history. But shout out to everybody that's involved in WWE. Those are the top, those are the bottom. Huge momentum. Hope they continue it going. But that is all I have for today. Again, don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast. And don't forget to like and share any Facebook posts that pique your interest, along with any Instagram posts, Twitter, Threads. I'm there, The Stunt, TikTok. We're all over the place. So I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. This is your host, Justin Jackson, signing out.